Okay. We're going to proceed with rate-regulated activities. We have contributions from our Canadian friends and our Korean friends. But I would first like to ask Mary to give an impression of the discussions that took place at IFES earlier this week.
I will do that. I was asked to step in on behalf of Michael Stewart, who was planning to be with us today but had a family issue that prevented him from being here, so I'm temporarily promoted to staff from that perspective. The two things I thought I would just note in the TF are where the ISB is today on rate regulated and then identify the two elements for discussion. In terms of where we are today, you'll see from the Agenda Paper 6 series for today's meeting the report of the update to the work plan that the agenda consultation and our subsequent deliberations confirmed that rate regulation, accounting for rate regulated activities, is an active standard setting project. I'll say personally, I think of the work as being more research in nature at this time, but we kind of have a foregone conclusion that we need to undertake standard setting given IFRS 14 being out there very much as a placeholder until we make further decisions. So think of this as still being research phase type work. I think our expectation is the next output will be a second discussion paper to build on the feedback we've had on consultation so far, discussions with our rate regulated advisory group and also ASAF and IFAS. We have gotten to a point, we have determined that we would like to try and develop a special model that applies when the characteristics of defined rate regulation exist, and the board has expressed a preliminary preference for that model being based on a revenue approach rather than a cost deferral approach. So that's kind of where we've gotten to. So against that background, what are we going to cover today? We have two sets of papers. One is a research paper prepared by the Canadian Accounting Standards Board that considers issues including the significance of rate regulation to the capital markets, the information needs of users in some inferred from their behavior in terms of the level of cross-border, of domestic and cross-border investment, and other inferred user needs about needs and benefits from recognition of regulatory assets and liabilities, as well as some observed practices. So you see they have excerpts from some notes yesterday. I see we have on our desk a copy. The presentation to IFAS included a pretty detailed walkthrough of the findings in the report and what was considered and what was considered significant, and identified some areas that I think Linda thought that others may want to pick up in terms of contributing research from especially outside of Canada to this. The second set of papers, again, also presented yesterday in the IFAS meeting, was the Korean Accounting Standards Board taking the brave step forward of saying, okay, the board has said that they are thinking about a revenue-based model. What might such a model look like? And the proposal focuses on how to integrate the relationship with the regulator, the notion of a tripartite relationship, customer, provider, and regulator, into a revenue-based model. It draws on concepts in IFRS 15, including variable consideration and the separation of revenue, of recognition of revenue from the timing of when revenue is collected, looking at separating those two things, and also considers whether the assessment of satisfying regulatory requirements, such as a requirement to build extra capacity or to repair on a fixed schedule, should be considered, and I'll speak in IFRS 15 terms, as a separate performance obligation or not. And so in today's papers, there's a build-out of that model with some questions about, you could take view A, view B on several of the key issues, and questions teed up for ASAF in that context about what a potential revenue model might look like. I think since each of the papers were distributed in advance, the hope is that we can spend most of the time discussing, probing, and challenging some of the proposals in both sets, proposals and findings. And I don't know, Michelle, if you had agreed a sequence in terms of handing over to Canada or Korea first.
We're going to go with Canada first. And
okay,
then
alphabetical order. Okay, I think that was the tee up just to set the scene in terms of what we heard.
Linda.
Thank you. And the slides that you have are not the same slides for those of you who were at IFAS. Yes, we were busy last night. So first of all, let me introduce Davina Tam, who has taken a lead on the drafting of the paper, although we do have another staff person, Karen Jones. Karen, raise your hand. These are two of the staff people that were involved in doing this paper. And as I said yesterday, I will walk through the comments that I want to make, but if you have questions, direct them to Davina. That's humor, okay? So first of all, I do have to give a disclaimer. In your introduction, Mary, you referred to this as an ACSB paper. This is actually the paper that you have underneath our due process is a staff paper. And that is simply a function of time, and we had to get it out for you guys to read. So the staff produced the paper over the summer. The board has now since deliberated, had their first deliberation on the paper, but officially what you see on the front page of it is that it's a staff paper. And I'll be able to relate some of the comments from our board discussion last week. The end result of our board discussion last week is we've directed the staff to seek input from other national standard setters, so I'll tell you that right now. Given the timing that we had over the course of the summer, the research is preliminary. You see in the paper that it focuses most on the Canadian data, simply because that was the data we could most readily get our hands on. There is some global data included, and we would like to build out the paper in terms of gathering more global data. The board has committed to continue to deliberate this topic, and in our next steps, we believe that we will be publishing this paper for comment, timing to be determined, as we decide the extent of the scope of the paper as we move forward. So if you look at slide three, I just want to set the context in terms of, in particular, the word regulation and versus rate regulation versus balances arriving from rate regulation. And we know that many industries around the world are regulated, but what we're talking about is the situation where there is a mechanism imposed by a rate regulator over the pricing that can be charged to customers. And typically that element has the notion of charging a fair price to customers, but also allowing the entity to get a fair return on expenditures they've made. It also is typically accompanied by the fact that that entity is operating in a monopolistic environment. We observe in the paper that there are some forms of rate regulation that we believe produce enforceable rights and obligations. And therefore, we've tried to differentiate in the paper in terms of, we use the phrase balances arising from rate regulation. We talk about the rights and obligations of an entity, and we talk about resulting from the performance of activities to provide goods or services. And so there is actually a connection here with what we will talk about when we get to the Korean paper in terms of their thinking. The important part on slide three, though, is we are differentiating between two elements. One is what the regulators are considering as this notion of the cost recovery that the entity is allowed to achieve versus the normal business risks that ultimately the entity needs to bear based on its performance, and that those costs would be borne by the investors or the owners. And so the box that we've placed around on that particular slide, we believe is the focus of the ISB's project. That's our understanding. So the paper, as you've seen it, is broken down into four sections. I'm just going to make a few observations on each of the sections, and then From my perspective, I definitely would rather have more discussion than me chatting. So there you go. Although I don't know this qualifies as chatting, but so if you look at, and I'm going to do these sections in a way, the same way I did them yesterday in terms of ordering, because as we, as a board last week, looked at the paper, there was a more logical ordering to the paper, and so I will just do that. So in terms of section one on slide four, we make the observation that due to the size of their market presence, rate-regulated entities are important to investors and lenders. So if you look at slide five, here's the data that we, in summary form, have presented that we think supports that. So in Canada, so just taking that view, this sector represents 6% of our total market cap. And so to give you some perspective on that, the biggest piece of that of our market cap would be financials, and that would be banks and insurance companies, and that's about 30%. Then we go into a category, this is the way the TSX combines things, we go into a category that's called diversified industries, that's 21%, and that really includes things like automotive, construction, consumer products, retail, so they combine that all in a caption called diversified industries, that's 21%. Oil and gas is 10%, mining is 7.8%, and then this falls in nicely at number five at 6%. If we were to disaggregate the diversified industries, it would likely that be likely that rate-regulated pops up a bit based on some preliminary work we've done. Suffice it to say, it's at least within the top five in terms of the impact on the Canadian economy. We also know that from a government-owned perspective, there's quite a bit of outstanding debt in Canada. They float bonds in particular, so there's $100 billion in outstanding debt. We've given you some statistics on that. And there's also investor-owned entities that have $90 billion in corporate debt, corporate bonds. And within the paper, we give you the breakdown of where that tends to reside. We have also given you some information about where the largest utilities are in terms of global presence, and they tend to reside in U.S. and Europe. And we've also given you the data we could find thus far on proposed investment in this sector. And the number that is quoted in the paper is $16.4 trillion, and we think that's a significant amount of investment. At this date, we don't know how much of that $16.4 million is devoted towards the so-called rate-regulated activities. We haven't been able to get that information. The other thing that we would do, and I'm trying to be very transparent in terms of the discussion, is we would like to find some information to corroborate that statistic, and so we'll be endeavoring to do that. In terms of part, I'm going to move on to the fourth section, our caption observation there is that the regulatory framework is a key factor. It's considered by debt and equity analysts and credit rating agencies, and there's also some data with regard to the acquisition level. We've looked at acquisitions. So if you look at slide seven, we try to give you some data, some factors on that. So in the paper, we talk about, equity, debt and equity analysts and credit rating agencies. There is a global component to the discussion around credit rating agencies because the large credit rating agencies have some parts of their process that are global in nature. So some of that is transferable beyond Canada and is global in nature. And we do know that the credit rating agencies look at whether or not an entity is rate regulated, and we know that they look at the strength of the regulatory environment in which the entity operates, and we know that when they determine that something has changed in that strength, that the entity can suffer a downgrade. And when they suffer a downgrade, it raises their cost to raise capital. So there is an economic impact from that. We also examine some purchase price allocations where we can observe these acquisitions in jurisdictions where rate-regulated accounting exists. We can see the carrying value that these balances have, and we can observe that the value ascribed to them, their carrying value, is similar to fair value. So on page eight, this is the snapshot that we give you with regard to the data for acquisitions, the trends in the Americas. Anecdotally, yes, I do read the paper. I can show you, I have here, this is the September 17th Globe and Mail. It's the Canadian business paper. And it talks about the recent M&A boom in Canada. They cite 7 deals, and 4 of them are in this sector. So significant acquisition activity, certainly from a Canadian perspective. If you look at then moving on to section 2, this is where we talk about the importance of understanding the regulatory framework. And within that section, if you look at slide 10, we try to break down for you our understanding of the components of the regulatory framework. So there's the legislation, there's the rules and procedures that the regulator follows to operate the rate setting mechanism, which we refer to as the form of rate regulation. And there's also regulatory decisions and subsequent court rulings that interpret, and we gave you some data on cases that we had looked at. We cite those in terms of their outcome and what the decisions were. Finally, in section 3, we talk about what users have told us in terms of their understanding of the strength of the regulatory framework and how they interpret it. They talk about enforceability, okay? They talk about the enforceability in the jurisdiction that they then understand as leading to the entity having rights and obligations resulting from their performance. And in that section, what we've built out, and if you look at slide 12, is we simply looked at data. We did a trend analysis for 12 Canadian companies looking at their balances over a 5-year period. And we did this because users had told us anecdotally that there were minimal impairments and minimal write-offs. So we actually went to the disclosures to prove that. And when you look at the disclosures, the note disclosures actually indicate that the write-offs or impairments typically happen when the rate regulator goes back in and looks at what the entity had actually included in their rate submission and decides that something should not have been in that rate submission. That's as opposed to the entity couldn't collect. So there is a much higher incidence of the rate regulator saying, no, you can't include that cost, as opposed to the entity having built that out and then not being able to collect that over the period of time that they are allowed to recover. And we thought that was an important observation.
Sorry, can you explain this again?
Sure. So when the entity is going about their rate setting, they submit a proposal to the rate regulator. And it's a very detailed proposal, Hans, and it has all kinds of line items that say this cost, this cost, this cost. What can happen is the rate regulator will give them a provisional approval, and then they will go back and do a much deeper dive into the submission. And when the regulator goes into that deeper dive, they'll say, okay, wait a minute. Yeah, you can't do that. You can include that cost. And then they will give an updated ruling. So in the paper, for instance, and Davina, keep me honest on these numbers, but we cited an example, I think it was Alberta, where the initial ruling was like 8.7%, and the ultimate ruling was you could do 8.3%. And the difference would be because the regulator said, no, you can't include that cost. It wasn't because they didn't ultimately recover the 8.3%, it was because the entity had included a cost they probably shouldn't have included. The regulations are quite detailed, and like anything else, you know, somebody reads it and they can interpret it slightly differently. So that's really what it means, Hans.
All right. Billed the customers for 8.7%.
So they would have to sell it up.
Yeah. Reverse everything.
It's very hard to decide everything ex ante. You know,
yeah.
All the services.
It's very complex.
But that phenomenon might not be that much different than a cost plus contract with the government, that there is a future debate about what costs were recoverable under a cost plus contract.
Completely.
Davina?
Oh, so maybe if I can add, it's looking for whether the costs have been prudently incurred. So that's why there would be a subsequent review in terms of the regulators looking into that.
Okay.
Okay. So, and then on slide 13, that's where we talk about enforceability, and we specifically use that word enforceability because that's the way the users have talked to us about it. And the users look at the strength or weakness of a particular jurisdiction, and they conclude on that, and then they assess, when they're thinking about the return from that entity, they look at the trend or write-offs, which I've just talked about, the expected recoveries, and they look for any subsequent regulatory decisions that could impact the entity's ability to recover. So from that perspective, while that, again, I've tried to walk through this really quickly, what I wanted to do is quickly encapsulate, since you all, I'm sure, very carefully read this paper, I wanted to go through that. I didn't think it was necessary to go through the same discussion that we had at IFES yesterday, and really allow as much time as possible for getting your thoughts, your observations, and your input. I think to conclude, where my, the deliberations from the Accounting Standards Board last week, it is clear to us that this is an important sector in Canada. If you look at the paper carefully, you will see the interconnectedness in North America. There are many deals being done, in this paper, you'll see deals being done where there are Canadian entities buying entities in the U.S. and vice versa. So there is a clear business framework that is existing within North America. The Accounting Standards Board has been very clear. We deferred the adoption for these entities four times. Four separate decisions where we decided whether or not we would put these entities onto IFRS before what came to be IFRS 14. So we have repeatedly acknowledged the importance of this industry within Canada. And therefore, the board is fully aware that this is a very important project from a Canadian perspective based on the data in the paper. We are staying away at this point from saying, here's the solution. We're not trying to come up with a solution. We are simply trying to say, what is the level of significance of this sector in terms of a standard setting process? And we believe it would be helpful if we could get similar data that is more globally based to move the discussion forward. And basically, that is what we are asking for others to help us with in helping us get that data from your jurisdictions. So with that, Hans.
Yeah, Linda, I have one more question about slide 13.
Okay.
Where you say, well, the users look at the strength or weakness, or relative strength of the regulatory framework. Does that mean that they see regulatory frameworks that are like grayish, where it is not so clear whether there are regulatory assets or liabilities?
There's within Canada, there's two levels of legislation. There's federal and there's provincial. The majority of the legislation in Canada on this topic is provincial, okay? But those users are also looking outside Canada, all right? So that's number one. Number two, within Canada, there's also different rate setting mechanisms. So if you look in the paper, it's the where we have the two boxes. There's the cost-based recovery, there's the incentive base, and there's what we call the hybrid. And so they're looking at all of those dimensions across the different provinces and also outside of Canada, because the legislation isn't exact between each of the provinces.
So I understand that, but I get the impression from that slide that users perceive there to be different shades of enforceability and, let's say, perhaps then also hardness of the assets or liabilities. I can imagine, especially in hybrid systems with incentives, that it's all not so clear cut whether there is a hard asset or a liability, or that it's soft.
Right. I'm agreeing with you on that. They do perceive that, but there is generally a fairly strong threshold within Canada on the presence of legislation that provides for the rate setting mechanism. But the users in Canada are very much following the work that's being done in terms of acquisitions. And there is, as I said, this big plethora of acquisitions being made outside of Canada, where the entities within Canada are looking for other opportunities to build out their companies. So they are looking at different rate-setting mechanisms beyond Canada. And within that, they're looking at the types of plans. There's a lot of talk about, well, this doesn't apply because we've got incentive-based, so they're not really like the traditional rate setting. When we dive into the definitions, and this is where it becomes very complicated, because you have to look at the definition of what's the so-called incentive-based. The majority that we're seeing where they are incentive-based are in effect what we call in the paper the hybrid. There's a base of cost recovery, and then what the regulator is saying is, but if you do this most efficiently, then, you know, there's the ruling. So there's a layer on top that's an incentive-based. So the more you look at this, the greater complexity you see within really understanding the facts and circumstances. I'm not sure I answered your question.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, but it probably, you know, if we go forward with this, then we will probably, in the standard, we'll have to have a very clear concept of what's in and what's out. We cannot live with shades of gray.
Well, which is why we think that a greater understanding of jurisdictions beyond Canada would be helpful to that understanding.
Yeah.
So Hans, sorry, if I might add,
yeah.
So like for the credit rating agency on page 43 of the report where the credit analyst would consider various factors in assessing the strength of the regulatory framework. So listed there a few were whether there'd be any like political interference, you know, how did they look at the recovery process? Was it in a timely manner? Was there a regulatory lag throughout? So there's a number of factors that they consider in determining their assessment of the regulatory framework.
You mentioned one which already makes it very complicated. I don't think we can make a stand that says, well, politically it should be inviolable or something. Okay, perhaps it's, you know, we can have a short round to see whether people from other parts of the world recognize this or say, well, for example, in Europe we don't see this landscape at all. I don't know. Patricia?
Well, Europe, like the rest of the world, has some people who are very strongly in favour, and I'm sure Alberto will speak to that because they've got very highly developed practices, and other parts of Europe where they may have something that would meet the definition of defined rate regulation, but it's not reported as such. So we do everything. But what we, in our discussions about this paper, one of the things that we really noticed and took.
Apart from the accounting practices, do we see a lot of rate regulation in Europe, or is it
there
more market-based?
It varies by jurisdiction, but yes, some jurisdictions do have it, and we certainly get, the UK is very strong on it. There's a lot of pressure from a number of jurisdictions that this project should go ahead.
Alberto?
Again, on slide 13, you say that users consider trend of write-offs or impairment of debit balances. Because you use the term trend, I might be wrong, in this case you correct me, means that there are a number of these write-offs of impairment. And this is surprising because in the various simplified examples we have been examining, we will be examining today and the previous meetings and so on, we always give for granted that the utility will get this amount. We take it for sure because we say there will be a rate adjustment next year. We might discuss whether this is revenue for this year or next year. We might discuss whether this is an asset or not an asset. But we always took for granted that was recoverable the year after. And you say there are impermanent write-offs. So
No. So what we said is that users will look to see if there is a trend. So maybe there's maybe we should have been more explicit on the slide. Okay, so users have told us is that they will look to see if there was a trend. Therefore, we put in the data for Canada, the fact that we see very minimal trending of write-offs. So, you know, that's what slide 13 is saying. The user said, I would look to see if there was a trend. we're seeing in Canada that there isn't really a trend of write-offs.
Jim?
More anecdotal, certainly, than the detail Linda has, but I think the environment in the U.S. would be very similar. That is, a strong history of cost recovery-based regulation with probably more recently some hybrid of incentive added. I think the trend of write-off would be very similar, meaning there really isn't a trend. And I found particularly interesting Section 4, which is the effect on really an analysis. And in a previous life, did a lot of work talking to users about if the U.S. were to move to a system that didn't recognize the regulatory compact, what would users in fact do? And they said it was very critical. An entity that wasn't subject to regulation would be analyzed entirely different than the impact of having that compact with the rate regulator, where they viewed that as creating information that was very helpful in their analysis of future cash flows. Whether you're in a, ignore the accounting for a second, but whether you're in a position that you need to reduce rates or in a position that you can increase rates, that they want to know that information, and certainly I think would have said it's useful to know in the financial reports as opposed to the notes. Again, talk about whether that should be a revenue model or a cost model, I think is certainly interesting.
Mary?
I'm not speaking about any one jurisdiction. I don't know if you want to get others' comments, because I had several, okay. Several questions and observations about the paper. One is on the general subject of enforceability that we've just been talking about. As I read it, and you know, thinking of the chart that Davina just cited to Hans, the one on the pages in the 40s, it seems that there's a bringing together of the notion of risk assessment probability with the term enforceability. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a distinction that we as accountants make and the users may not make, because for them, if they're assessing what's the risk that jurisdiction X won't enforce the published rate regulation, they really seem to be looking at what's the probability of recovery. So I think as I think about this research and how I might use it, it tells me that they might not be making that distinction, but maybe I've been spending too much time on conceptual framework and the notion of the elements, definition, and control. And when I say how enforceability, how do I actually control that asset?
That's right.
I think I don't look as much at risk and the probability of recovery as I do what is my mechanism. And as I step back, it's not in here. What I boiled it down to is the enforceability that's given to me as a rate-regulated entity is the promise to preclude others from competing to offer this product, right, which is why I get to it's really that the enforceability is based on that ability to keep others out of the market, and that's the only control. So I think it might be helpful in taking anything forward to separate enforceability from risk assessment and probability of collection, but I think that's our construct rather than users' construct, because I can see that they combine it. In terms of where might there be evidence in looking at fair value, the acquisition transactions and the value, it looked based on the notes taken from companies reporting under U.S. GAAP that generally the balances recognized by the acquiree end up not being adjusted,
right,
and kind of carried forward. Some had the statement that said they believe that,
right,
historical cost approximates fair value.
Right.
And I guess I was struggling thinking about it, but I don't know the industry that well, and I'm just wondering if that's a convention that kind of has become established, because if, let's say, your rate regulator is allowing a return of 4% on capital and expenditure in a 1% interest rate environment, then that amount that you're going to collect that represents a 4% return presumably would have a fair value that's higher than what was recognized on a historical cost basis. And The other type of source of information that could come to mind was if there are any breakups or sharp shifts in regulatory approaches. And the examples I can think of from an America's perspective, one goes back lo these many years now, is the breakup of AT&T into the competing regional telcos, and what happened, you know, with the billions of stranded assets that ended up being written off, and also some of the deregulation in California that created some crises in that market. And so in terms of research, looking at what happened and how the perception of value changed, and what that also says about enforceability. And I also saw, and I didn't have time to go back and look at the study that was done and presented here by our colleagues from Japan about goodwill. But when you looked at, you know, the argument was, it's good to have these separately recognized items, because it reduces the amount that's thrown into the blob of goodwill. Right. And yet the goodwill proportions seemed reasonably high, kind of 50, 60, 70%. And when I think about the study of goodwill as a proportion of assets, et cetera, that those numbers didn't seem to be lower than you would find in other transactions. So it might be interesting to pull the Japanese study of goodwill and see how those proportions come out. And so I think the last thing that struck me going through the different sections was that I think a key question for us in our deliberations will be, if there's either hybrid or incentive-based, does it matter how wide the range is? You know, so if you can keep, if the regulator says you can't earn a return of more than 5%, but you don't have to return anything if you have cost savings, et cetera, so you can keep it, so you might actually earn a higher return in the end. How wide does that be before it's not really before it's not really rate regulation, and really getting more data about how many schemes are hybrid and how wide the margins are might be another point, because I'm not sure how much it's really tightly rate regulated when you factor in that hybrid incentive thing. So those were a kind of sweep of issues from the different sections, but it was really good because it made me think separately about all those items.
Kimberly.
Just to firstly explain the New Zealand context, because everybody's context no doubt informs that. Forms their view. We do have rate regulated entities in New Zealand. There aren't large numbers of them, but they certainly exist, not the cost of service type that's been under discussion. Historically, for accounting purposes, we have never recognised regulatory balances as assets or liabilities. Both in our pre-IFRS days and our post-IFRS days. In our pre-IFRS days, we had conceptual framework, which was essentially the ISB conceptual framework, and so there's a long-held view amongst everybody that they don't meet those definitions, so it's never been permitted to recognise them. Now, in terms of does that leave users without useful information, certainly someone with at least one in particular I'm very familiar with has information disclosed in the notes, both around the regulatory environment and the estimated amounts of those regulatory balances. So I think probably in terms of taking it forward, and I think it was something that was discussed at the IFAS meeting, was to see if we can get more information from investors who are used to looking at financial statements without those regulatory balances on the face of the balance sheet, but are getting it through the notes or some other avenue to sort of understand. It doesn't necessarily mean to say, because we all know that the notes are not a substitute for what goes in the balance sheet, but I think that is worthwhile exercise thinking about, because the challenges of the project in trying to come up with something that's going to work in terms of even if we create what I would consider special accounting in terms of permitting the balances to be recognised, It's then about how do you then scope it, some of the issues that you were mentioning, Hans, and others, about making which particular type of rate regulation is going to be within this pool. So which ones may fall out of it, even though they might be actually quite similar, and does that create a significant difference between quite similar industries? And the other concern, of course, is around potential contagion effects, in that if you create a special accounting, in particular that allows the recognition of assets in certain circumstances, how do you stop people from analogising that in quite different non-rate regulated environments, or the ones that fall outside the scope, and saying, well, okay, if it's okay in that situation, then I can do it. So those are the things that would need to be worked through. And I think just one other thought I had, something that Mary said triggered a point when you were talking about control and can you keep other people out of that activity. I guess you were assuming that because it's typically applied in areas where there are natural monopoly, that it's not physically possible for someone else to come along and compete with that person, because it would be economically difficult to create alternative infrastructure. I guess is that what that you were meaning by you can't actually legally keep them out, but economically they're kept out by the economics.
I think it in the circumstances described for Canada,
right?
I think you actually can legally
That's
keep
correct.
Them out, because you have
That's
to be
correct.
Licensed to be a transmitter.
Yeah.
In this area, and they will only give one license in that area. I think the fuzziness that we've identified so far is there may only be one entity licensed to distribute electricity. Well, it's not it, but is there a gas supplier who's able to come in and compete as people switch between energy providers? But there may only be one gas provider, or, you know, so it's, I think there is probably a license issue that makes it legal as well as the economic hurdles.
Yeah. That's certainly the situation we would have, that it's there's no prevention for somebody to come in and do something differently. So either switch to different, you know, energy sources, yeah. as you've said, or... I was talking to the operator of our national grid at one point, and they were saying that there's a limit to how much they could raise prices anyway, because with some of their major customers, if they happen to be near a electricity generator, there comes a point where it's actually economical for them to build a line between the generator and the customer, and bypass the national grid. So you could get those kinds of situations.
So you're saying that it's barriers to entry in the marketplace rather than regulation? That keeps it out.
Yeah,
okay.
And just to clarify the Canadian situation, it's by regulation, and in order for the entity to leave, they have to get regulatory approval. So it's by law.
Those same enforceable rights, though, are in some cases not that different than a service concession arrangement, which has justified the recording of assets and liabilities. There is no right to force someone to cross a toll bridge. You know, people could find maybe alternative means, and somehow that has been a basis for recording assets and liabilities.
I think those of us that disagree with recognition, what we're disagreeing with is the pieces. We agree that the regulatory agreement is likely to be an intangible asset, a type of asset. As you say, you've got those rights. You've got the rights to operate in that industry. You've got the rights to provide the services and charge people for it. So we would agree that there is certainly enforceable rights there. And we would see the right to increase the price as an enhancement of that asset, so that if you've got the right to charge the base price, if you have a right to increase it, that's an enhancement of that asset. And if you have to reduce it because you've overbuilt, then we would see that as essentially an impairment of that asset. So we're not disagreeing about them being assets. I think we're just disagreeing that those regulatory balances in and of themselves is distinct from the bigger picture. So
I was just getting to the question of enforceability. In many cases, these are no more or less enforceable than a service concession arrangement. That's not all.
Yeah. And in a service concession arrangement, you would have that, typically that big asset, wouldn't you, for the right to charge users?
That nuance escapes me. So you agree there is something there?
Yes. So if you take actually the service concession arrangement, where typically you would have this intangible asset if it's a right to charge as opposed to the financial asset model. So that asset represents your right to charge, you know, to provide those services with toll road or whatever it is and collect tolls, and we consider that to be an asset. We also think in a regulatory environment that your regulatory agreement with the regulator in itself creates an asset, because
yeah.
there are enforceable
yeah.
rights and obligations in that regulatory agreement, and I think the Canada paper shows how valuable that is, and investors
yeah.
see that that's great that you operate in this regulatory environment, because you've got a nice stable income, you've got a regulator who is not only looking after the customers and not charging too much, also is looking after the entity. And in terms of saying, yes, we need to make sure you can carry on making a reasonable return, which I think most companies would love to have somebody ensuring their continued existence like that. So it's clearly a valuable...
Now we have a mechanism to recognise this intangible asset,
yeah.
and Australia
yeah.
and New Zealand should be saying hooray.
Yeah, but I guess if we go down the route, we would like the whole asset. We wouldn't. Our concern is you're taking a piece of the asset, so that... If, as a consequence of what's happened in the past, you have a right to increase your prices in the future, which is your debit regulatory balance, we would see that's an enhancement of your existing asset. So if you think of the right to charge $2, which is what you charged in the past, you now have got a right to charge $2.10, great, you've got a better asset. And if it went the other way and you now have to charge $1.90 in the future instead of $2,
yeah.
then you've got an impairment of that existing asset, which at the moment is not recognised. So we see these regulatory balances as increases and decreases of an unrecognised asset.
Okay, so but isn't it better to then at least recognise those increases and decreases rather than not recognising anything at all?
I think it depends on what you mean by better. If you mean better by user information, these because it provides useful information, so you're appealing to the higher concept of user information needs. I mean, the arguments we've been having is around the element piece of it, that is these pieces individually, do they individually represent assets or liabilities, which we don't see that they do. We can see that the bigger asset may do, and therefore you could look at should you recognise the bigger asset or should you provide disclosures, because we can see it's useful information. Because it's clearly, I think, the Canada... it clearly shows that users are interested in this information, and then becomes how best to do it. And as I say, our concerns have been around putting them on the balance sheet, because you want to provide that useful information via the balance sheet. How do you then scope that special accounting? How do you prevent the contagion event? Basically, how do you get to the outcome you're looking for to provide that useful information without creating harm along the way, and therefore that's why we think potentially disclosures might be a better route.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We are taking up a lot of time, and we also want to discuss the Korean paper, and we have 1 hour left, less, so I ask everybody to be a bit short. Jang-woo?
Very short. This paper is a really good paper. It's showing a kind of positive evidence on this regulated activities accounting. So you are explaining economically these are financial effects are very important. You showed it here. And also you are using a good recognition of assets and liabilities. That accounting system is working very right, because investors are happy, users are happy with this kind of information. So this is a really good evidence on this part, or another part of the world, economically important, accounting information important, so perfectly good evidence. However, the other world, economically very important, but we are not providing good accounting information, there is another world. So we are tackling with that world to provide some kind of accounting standard first. So that's the first impression I got from this very outstanding, you know, the survey a research paper. But technically I would like to say 2 points here. One is you said there is a very interesting comment in paragraph 100. You said there are regulated assets have higher valuation multiples compared with the unregulated assets. This is a very interesting observation you made, I think. Basically, this is the evidence of U.S. GAAP. You know, basically, the U.S. GAAP is based on cost-to-default method.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So we are proposing a kind of a revenue-based model.
Right.
So I guess if we have a higher multiples on those recognized assets according to US GAAP, maybe that's a little small amount. That's why I'm not sure, just my guessing, if you have a good knowledge on this, whether this signal implies a kind of still some imperfectness of a cost different method to recognize regulated assets and liabilities. Is it right? My understanding is right?
Okay.
So this was based on gathering data looking at acquisitions in general, not specifically the accounting that created the regulated assets. So this paragraph was actually more like when you have a regulated business, the valuation multiples seem higher than those in an unregulated assets, because in a regulated business, to get into that, you have more of a monopolistic kind of environment, yielding possibly more of a stable cash flow and stable cash flows and earnings. So this statement here is not specifically tied to whether it's a cost deferral or whether it's a revenue recognition, but just in general, the business itself being in a regulated, rate-regulated environment versus an unregulated environment.
Yeah, another thing is your observation you have made here is you are saying the carrying amount of the regulatory asset, if you recognize that it's quite close to the fair value of the regulatory asset, there is another paragraph you have saw, right?
Yeah. So that in itself is speaking directly to those regulatory deferral accounts. So I think of it as there's the regulated business. So you're paying a premium to enter into a market that's more monopolistic. But now on those purchase price allocations, when we examined, we looked at it and said, what do the market participants ascribe to those balances? And those balances they view as the carrying value approximates fair value. So that is arising from the accounting per se.
If I may comment on that, I believe the answer to this question, Brazil is a very good counter example.
Right.
Because as companies adopt IFRS 2010, they're not recognizing regulatory assets. And what is happening? Every company published two sets of financials. So it's absolutely a counter example, because it's relevant. So it's like in Canada, there's a hybrid model like the US, but companies are presenting two separate sets of accounts, so it's a general. I believe it's a counter example. Nobody uses the typical IFRS standard. They use this adjusted IFRS as a practice in Brazil since 2010. Is what the Securities and Exchange Commission of Brazil commented on the letter that was sent to them.
That's right.
So I believe it's a good complement to the place. Just another quick question is: have you been through a regulatory liabilities?
Preliminary paper. Did you hear me say we did as much as we could in the time?
No, it's
a fair comment, because we're going to move forward with this paper and we're going to build it out.
Yeah, but have you seen this, or have you
regulatory liabilities?
Yeah,
we have that too. So in the paper here, we've kind of shown we've shown a proportionate. In terms of the trend.
I saw that. I'm just saying you're going to pay more attention.
Yes, we are. We're going to continue to build it up.
Because it's something that happens to appear a lot. So.
Sorry, is that in your jurisdiction?
Yes. In my jurisdiction, something quite relevant, because sometimes you have a fixed a cap on price.
Yes.
What's happening is your costs get growing up for several reasons, and you get a cap on price, so you end up having a regulatory liability. Because you have to provide a service below your expected profit margins.
If you don't mind.
Onerous contract. Should be an onerous contract in this case.
Yeah, but you end up with a liability because you have to.
Okay, Nobu, and then we go to the solution as provided by our
community. Okay, thank you very much. We found this paper very informative, and we commend the Canadian board for putting this paper together.
Thank you.
We do not have experience recognizing regulatory assets, and we are fine not recognizing it. But if the ISB were to proceed with this project, we are of the view that defined rate regulation, as it was proposed, is too narrow in scope. And we would support the idea in this paper about the strength of the regulatory framework to be considered when we are to expand the scope. So if we are to recognize certain assets, then we will look at this strength of the regulatory framework.
So what do you mean by this exactly? What is the underlying thought?
I think that the proposed definition is too narrow. If you like to expand it in one way or the other, we would consider this strength of the regulatory framework as one factor to consider whether it would be within the scope or not.
So if we go overboard, we should go overboard in a more wholesale manner? Is that what you're saying? Or?
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it that way. But, well, we are concerned that if we use this defined rate regulation as it is today, it's so narrow, and the effect of entities that would be in this scope and not would be so significant that it would probably not provide useful information. There would be some that are very similar that would have totally different treatments. So if we
so that's the definition that was in the discussion paper. You were saying
it's
too narrow, and
yes.
Particularly point D, the bit about enforceability.
Yes.
Mm. This is exactly where what our Chinese friends are extremely nervous about. No? Can I speak for you, Jen Chao? I would like to give the floor to Sang Su now.
Okay, thank you. Our motivating point of this research is that you know the IFRS 15 would not be a stable platform to develop a revenue-based approach model. These rate-regulated entities. But we believe that the IFRS 15 should be a starting point to develop a new recognition model of the rate-regulated entities by analyzing to IFRS 15 core concepts distinct obligation, performance obligation, and the consideration and the timing of recognizing revenue should be considered in developing a new recognition model for the rate-regulated entities. As explained in the agenda paper 3B, agenda paper 3BA compares differing views as to how to account for the difference between regulatory revenue requirement, that is the revenue in accordance with rate regulation, and contract revenue, that is revenue in accordance with contracts with customers. In agenda paper 3BA explores and assesses the rationales for each differing views in the light of the current conceptual framework and IFRS 15. And agenda paper 3BA addresses the differing views in agenda paper 3BA on how to account for revenue requirement adjustment using an illustrative example of raw material cost for the adjustment of revenue requirement as a simple case. Lastly, the agenda paper 3BC addresses the differing views in agenda paper 3BA on how to account for this revenue requirement adjustment using an illustrative example of construction cost of for the adjustment of revenue requirement as a complex case. With regard to the agenda paper 3BA, I have covered the topics in the following order. From analysis 1, I have reviewed the economic substance of rate-regulated activities under defined rate regulation. Yes, of course, under defined rate regulation is too narrow, but we need to start our discussion from the rigid mechanism to define rate regulation, and then we could expand the scope further. And then in analysis two, I have reviewed regulatory assets and liabilities recognized in the revenue recognition model of rate regulated entity in the context of the conceptual framework. Lastly, in analysis three, I would like to discuss what the performance obligation would be and the timing of revenue recognition when developing a new revenue recognition model for rate regulated activities to be derived from IFRS 15 core concepts. First, analysis one, as described in paragraph 5 of this paper, to consider the economic substance of rate-regulated activities in the context of the revenue approach, it would be necessary to understand the accounting requirements in IFRS 15. As you can see in figure 1, IFRS 15 addresses accounting treatments based on the contract only between a supplier and a customer. The accounting for rate-regulated activities in accordance with IFRS 15 would not fully represent the economic substance because the tripartite, the supplier, the customer, and the regulated relationship of the rate-regulated activities affects the mechanism of determining the consideration for transferring goods or services to customers. Figure 2 illustrates the interaction among the supplier, customer, and rate regulator, and also the effect of the rate regulation on the relationship between the supplier and the customer. Analysis 2 covers the analysis of whether regulatory assets and liabilities satisfy the definition of asset and liability in the context of a conceptual framework. In our view, under defined rate regulation, the rate regulated entity obtained the control under defined rate regulation. Yeah, I think it holds. I explained it using the case of raw material cost in agenda paper 3BB. In analysis 3, the paragraph 15 of the thereafter of this paper, I discussed the timing of revenue recognition for underbilled and overbilled revenue requirement using IFRS 15 as a platform. Maybe the platform is a vulnerable platform, not stable, but we could analyze core concepts from the cost standard. One focuses only on the contract between the supplier and the customers, but view two holds that in the rate regulation, revenue amount should not be determined only by contracts with customers, but also by reflecting the revenue requirement adjustment established in the regulatory agreement. Under defined rate regulation, it would be more appropriate in terms of economic substance to view that the consideration of the performance obligation towards customers is determined by the regulatory agreement rather than the contract between the entity and the customers. As shown in paragraph 24 of this paper and the paragraphs following thereafter, although the revenue requirement including the adjustment in year one is not an explicit variable consideration in the contract with the customers. It is a variable consideration for the performance obligation satisfied in accordance with the regulatory agreement in year one. Next, I discussed the timing of revenue recognition for input activities. Costs, that's a performance obligation, with the case of construction of a plant. According to view 2A, the rate regulator represents collective customers and enters into the agreement with the rate regulated entity in the capacity of collective customers. In this sense, the promise established in the regulatory agreement is deemed as the performance obligation of the rate regulated entity to the customer. And on the other hand, according to view 2B, the entity should not identify the obligation to conduct input activities. For example, to construct a plant as a distinct performance obligation and thus recognizes its revenue when it satisfies the performance obligation to transfer goods or services to customers. Due to B, it has its rationale in paragraph 29 of IFRS 15. An input activity should be combined with the output activity, for example, to transfer natural gas to customers as a bundle of goods or services. And these two activities are highly interdependent or highly interrelated, as stated in paragraph 29 of IFRS 15. Finally, we propose developing a new accounting model for rate-regulated activities as follows. First, the rate-regulated activity recognizes its revenue, reflecting the revenue requirement adjustment when it satisfies the performance obligation to transfer goods or services to customers. Second, the timing of revenue recognition is not dependent on when the consideration for transferring goods or services is billed or contractually billable to a customer under this situation. Lastly, the obligation for input activities that are the rate regulator requires the rate regulated entity to perform, for example, the construction of a PPE to produce goods or services is not separately identified for revenue recognition, and the revenue requirement that is a consideration for those input activities will be recognized as revenue when the cost of the related asset is expensed. For example, as the PPE is depreciated, because depreciation means using the plant, using the asset, and it will contribute to the satisfying the performance obligation to transfer goods or services to customers. This new model based on the revenue approach would be consistent with the definition of asset and definition of liability in the current conceptual framework for financial reporting. Moreover, the new model would be in better balance with the requirements of IFRS 15. In conclusion, we think that the new model would represent faithfully the economic substance of the rate-regulated activities and enhance the inter-company comparability among rate-regulated entities and non-regulated entities. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Mary?
Reflecting on the discussion yesterday at IFAS, as well as some of the work we've done here before, I thought I'd say the things that I thought it would be most interesting to me to hear, from the ASAP members, really on three points of this package of papers. One is agreement or disagreement with the basic proposal that you have that we should be basing the accounting on the tripartite arrangement rather than saying you have, as a rate-regulated entity, two relationships, one with the customer that you account for and one with the regulator. I think you're saying you have to bring those two together as a single relationship. And what are people's response to that, given what you've worked through in terms of how rate regulation affects how the relationship with the regulator affects the relationship with the customer? So that was one thing. The second is your analysis drawing on IFRS 15 and the identification of performance obligation for your conclusion that satisfaction of the requirement imposed by the regulator, what you called input activity, is integrated with and should not be separated from delivery to the customer. And get people's reaction on that point, that you know that you should think of it all as combined. And I would separate out the third point that you just made in your wrap-up, which is the answer to the question, so if you integrate it, when do you recognize revenue for the satisfaction of the input activity obligation? Because you had proposed, as the item is consumed, therefore as depreciation is recognized. And my take from yesterday's IFAS discussion was that when question, and you know, the linking to depreciation got a lot of challenges, and I think it would be a hard question to answer, but maybe I'd just say to people to, it would be helpful if we could maybe separate out that when from the, do you think it makes sense to view it as integrated? And then we, you know, if they do, then we can wrestle with the question of when. But if they don't, then we shouldn't get distracted by the when would you recognize it.
Thanks, Hans. Yeah, unfortunately, obviously not being at national standard setters, I'm not sure what the discussion was and wasn't able to participate. But I must say, from the start, I guess I've been very resistant to rate-regulated assets and liabilities. But I must say, this IFRS 15 approach of looking at everything together, I don't know, I think it certainly has some merit, because what I was thinking is that, you know, even though you don't have a contract with a single customer and you're going to, you know, be requiring that customer necessarily to be paying you more in future, if we were to consider the contracts with the customers on a portfolio basis and therefore bringing in the rate regulation, effectively my understanding of view two would be to say that based on the rate regulation, we're using as an example, in year one we should be earning 1,000. But if we don't end up by earning 1,000, either because, well, the demand wasn't there, or otherwise maybe 1,000 should have been higher because the costs were actually higher, and if we'd known that the costs were going to be higher, we should have been earning 1,200 or whatever the number was, that effectively, as you're saying, it is like variable consideration, and that's the agreement, that's your consideration with the customer. And that does relate to the services that you have rendered in that year. So had you known everything at the end of the year that you now know, if you'd known all of that up front, your contract consideration would have been a different number for the services that you rendered in the current year. So I must say, I think I have a lot of sympathy for this IFRS 15 model, where you say, but it does require one to see the contract with the customers on a portfolio basis, effectively. It doesn't work if you see it on an individual basis, and it therefore does require the rate regulation to be considered together. So, yeah, I must say I think I have a lot of sympathy for considering a model like this, whereas I don't, and I think it's because it is based on the revenue as opposed to based on costs being capitalized as an asset. So a question that I did have, and again, I think once I got my mind around this, your example of then the requirement to build PPE, and I was very pleased then that, you know, because there you're not transferring anything to the customer, I agree that you wouldn't have revenue recognition in that year, and Mary's right, we then have to deal with the timing of the recognition, and somehow it's got to be linked to the goods or services transferred to the customers in the future. The question that I did have was, if there's a requirement to clean up certain, you know, so maybe there's been some kind of spillage or whatever it is, contamination or whatever it might be relevant, and you've been required to incur those costs, and those costs will be recovered in future, would you, when would you recognize that revenue? Because, is the thinking that, well, had you known that those costs were going to be incurred in the current year's revenue would have been higher? So in that example, would you have linked it to the goods or services provided in the current year? Or would you say, well, no, that doesn't relate to the goods or services in the current year, and would you only be recognising that revenue in future? that for me, I wasn't quite sure which way you would have gone in your paper.
In our opinion, we can set a principle that the entity will recognize the revenue when the related costs will be expensed. Because the logic is that when it is expensed, it means the customer uses the asset, or maybe all items could be as asset. Even some assets will be consumed immediately when the entity expands. It is easy to follow when the cost will be expensed to recognize revenue.
So in my example, where there were these cleanup costs, so you're not generating an asset or creating an asset that's going to generate future benefits, but you've had to incur these costs, would you be saying, well, you need to expense those costs in the current period, and hence you would recognize the revenue in the current period as well?
Yeah, current. The logic is, I think, the cost should be expensed currently means that the costs should be matching to the revenue, current revenue. The revenue, so the cost that is currently expensed could be deemed as a contribution to the currently satisfying the obligation, performance obligation.
Okay, so it's related to the performance
related
in the
to,
current
yeah,
year.
Current, revenue. So the simple principle could be right that when the cost will be expensed, it would be concurrently recognized. Revenue currently will be recognized.
Okay, Jim?
So I hadn't traditionally thought about this as necessarily a revenue issue versus cost deferral, but I think this paper was helpful in that. And I agree with Kim that if you think about it, as the tripartite arrangement, you would likely need to be very clear that it is not because of the tripartite arrangement that the regulator is the customer, that the customer is still the consumer, but then you look at the consumer as the portfolio of consumers versus the one-to-one consumer, which is IFRS 15. It doesn't let you look at a portfolio of purchases and say that the contract is with a group of customers. It is based upon individuals. So if you were going down the revenue path, I think it'd be important to say that somehow the nature of rate regulation makes the customer base versus the individual customer. I think then if you still say, well, within that is the performance obligation, the provision of services, then you would figure out what the revenue you are entitled to from that customer base is, if you use the variable consideration, which might result in the matching of expenses with revenue, but indirectly, meaning I have to figure out the total consideration I would be entitled to and then allocate that to each performance obligation.
Right.
And if the total consideration I'm entitled to is driven by my costs, then you might get that indirect matching, not in the bad sense, but the fact that your costs drive your revenue. And so I think that's how you might end. Now, I hadn't thought of the tri-party arrangement as resulting in the customer becoming the base, but I think that would have to be seemingly the basis under, and it would have to be, I think, I would be concerned if it wasn't an amendment to 15 or saying this is a discrete model only for, and then you got to define the population.
Yeah.
Patricia?
We discussed this with our national standard setters and had a heated debate as usual. I think the results were what I'd call a skewed distribution, where roughly half were roughly comfortable with the picture, and the other half were had diminishing degrees of comfort but were happy to explore it. And I then talked to some of those diminishing degrees of comfort people to try and understand what the problems were. I think probably the primary problem is this focus on the income statement, and we put the missing bits in the balance sheet. So the question is, if we say, as appears to be a key feature of defined rate regulation, that the revenue is guaranteed regardless of demand and delivery, then shouldn't we consider whether at the point of signing a regulatory agreement, we don't have some sort of contract receivable under IFRS 15, and then under or over delivery, under unexpected events, are going to be adjustments to that contract receivable. So that's the first area where people seemed to be uncomfortable. The second area was also balance sheet based, and it was this sort of assumption that somehow we would measure property, plant and equipment under IAS 16, and then we would fix the revenue bit and the depreciation bit to make sure that they run off at the same time. But we don't haven't agreed whether it should run off over the cash receipt period, over the IAS 16 depreciation period, or somewhere in between. What nobody has seemed to consider and needs to be considered, we don't have an answer, is whether in fact if you're fully reimbursed for the cost of an asset and you want to stick with cost accounting, is your asset base zero? So we think that those two bits of the balance sheet, or the people who were doubtful about the what I'm going to call the pure IFRS 15 approach, thought that the problems were this focus on purely on income, fix it on the balance sheet, rather than thinking in terms of, well, what does this agreement with the regulator actually mean? So to answer Mary's questions, I think everybody agrees that the fact that you've got a rate regulator in a defined rate regulation form does create a different set of dynamics and a different set of economics from what I call a normal market relationship. That, yes, IFRS 15 is a good way to go, but it's not the end of the story. And certainly we think the people who are concerned about it, and even the people who are reasonably comfortable, thought that this inputs problem hadn't really been resolved. More work, it was a sort of more work needed.
Andreas?
Directly following from what Patricia was saying, and I was part of that uncomfort zone camp. I think if you combine what Kimberly said before, that there is an asset that currently we don't recognize, the rights that we receive from the regulator, and that is seeing changes, ups and downs, how do you reconcile those to the revenue bit? Are they two different things? So you have the relation with the regulator and you just look at that regulatory asset, whatever it is, that right? And there is a separate performance obligation and account for that. Is there a risk that you actually double count? Because part of the changes in that regulatory asset probably will also show up with your binary customer relationship. So I think that there is an issue. I think it's neither exclusively a revenue model that will work. It's neither the sole balance sheet approach, record a regulatory asset. But I'm also hesitant to say, well, take this tripartite agreement into account. Why? Because I think it's not really tripartite, as Kim has mentioned. The third party is really a huge group. It's a huge portfolio because it isn't the relationship vis-a-vis that one customer, but it is the customer base. It's an anonymous group of customers. And I was wondering how much we would stray into other territory where we have similar issues. I was thinking by myself of dynamic risk management, for instance, where we would say, well, is there a single customer? Are we talking about the customer base? So I'm just wary how we could confine it, really, and I think more thinking is needed. I'm certainly happy to say let's explore the revenue bit, because that has to be looked at, but I don't think you can say exclusively that will do the trick.
Jen Chow.
Thank you. First of all, I appreciate our the report made by our Korean colleagues that it helped me that understand from revenue approach how to find a solution for the rate regulatory activities. But I'm a little bit confused about that. Under this approach, does it mean that we do not necessarily to have a separate accounting standard or requirements for rate regulatory activities? We simply just revise some wording or requirement of the IFRS 15. Is it correct?
I'll tell you how I read it when I was going through my thing, which is, well, because I think part of the impetus for the CASB to do this paper was based on the board's discussion, so I feel some self-inflicted responsibility, yes, is to say, rather than pursuing a cost deferral approach, let's look at an adjustment of the timing of revenue. So this is not an interpretation of IFRS 15. It is not scoping limited amendments to 15, but it says if you try and approach building a special model focused on the timing of revenue recognition rather than on cost deferral, what might that model look like? And because we have thought through so much with IFRS 15 recently, to pull on some of the concepts in IFRS 15 to say, what does that tell you about, for example, combining or separating performance obligations? But it's not either an interpretation or an application guide to 15.
It would have to be a new standard,
yes,
or some significant amendment to IFRS
15. Don't even think about amending. No, no amendments to 15.
Kimberly.
Well,
Jen Chan, sorry.
Yes, because the paper makes reference to the IFRS 15, mainly the requirements of the progressive revenue recognition over time, and also the concept of variable consideration in IFRS 15 to support the conclusion or the recommendations. But from my understanding, I think the requirement for progressive revenue recognition over time in IFRS 15, I have a different understanding, because the progressive method, actually, it is not based on whether, you know, the payment billable to customer or not. It's still based on the performance obligation, whether the company has performed. But if we look at the rate regulated activities, actually at that time, although you make adjustments of the rate, but at that time, the company has not yet provided any, you know, goods or services to the customers. So that means the performance obligation has not yet performed. So I think the concept or the requirement for progressive revenue recognition over time in IFRS 15 cannot provide a sound, you know, concept to support the recommendation. And secondly, also we use the concept of variable consideration in IFRS 15. In my understanding, variable consideration always based on the performance of the goods. If the goods you provide a customer, you know, the performance is better than expected, maybe you can receive more money. But for rate-regulated activities, the regulator allowed the company to make adjustments increasing the price. I think it's simply just price adjustment. And the price still not variable price, it's still fixed price. And it's not based on the performance of the product and the service you provide that to the customer. I think it's a different situation. So I also don't think it could provide sound, you know, concept to support your recommendation. And also with regard to the revenue recognition for overbuild the revenue requirement, you suggested that. It seems that the first bunch of the customer, you overbill, and then you have to reduce the price in the future. But if I don't see, because there is a legal contract with the entity and the customers. If we say that, if the accounting say that you overbuild, it seems that we are changing the legal relationship between the entity and the customer. And whether the former customer can sue you that I overpaid, because the legal relationship is related to the former customer, not the future customer. So I think what's the accounting we need to do? We simply just reflect the real situation, real price, real legal relationship between the customer or the entity, even if it's so-called overpaid. But I still believe that when the entity and the customer sign the contract, at that time, it is still fair price. We cannot say that it's overbuild. So we cannot use futures, some cost or other data to justify that overbuild. We cannot change the legal relationship and the real economic substance. But based on our suggestion, it seems that we are trying to change this kind of legal relationship and this kind of price mechanism. I think it will be a danger, because in China, as I mentioned before, there are a lot of rate regulated activities there. If we change this kind of accounting method, and people will raise their hand, will go to government because we are overpaid. Yeah, you have to return the money to us, and accounting numbers show that how much money you have overpaid. I think it will be dangerous, you know, for accounting standards. What we really want to first of all present our economic reality or economic activities.
Kimberly.
Well, I'm going to agree with a lot of what Gentile and Andreas has said. I certainly think it was a great idea to have a go at applying IFRS 15 to see if you can come up with the solution you're looking for. I think that was certainly a very useful exercise. And I also was pleased to see View 1 in there. So tick that box, definitely. But I think the concerns, and I think it's following on from Jan Charles' comments and the discussion we had yesterday about trying to apply the principles of IFRS 15 and the treatments to a different context, because, I mean, as you've said in your paper, the IFRS 15 was developed for a contract with an individual customer, and everything in it is built around that relationship between the entity and the customer, that individual customer, and what did you agree to provide them, how much have they agreed to pay you for those goods and services, and giving things like that variable consideration and other things, and it were all designed around that. And yeah, I do feel that they've been taken out of context now. The idea has been taken that was developed in one context and applied in a different context. And I think if you take away the underlying principles that on which that treatment was based, it then becomes very difficult, which Gentile has just really explained very well. And then that's why I'm concerned about this idea about bringing in the tripartite relationship and looking at this customer base as a portfolio, which is not even a fixed portfolio because it's got new and old customers coming in all the time. And I think if you were to do it, we would actually have to account for all the transactions of the customers twice, because first of all, we definitely still need to account for the transactions with those individual customers using IFRS 15. We still need to think about when we're going to recognise revenue for them, and then I think we'd have to have an overlay to say, well, we've done that accounting, now let's apply a regulatory overlay and manage our total revenue number to get back to whatever answer it is we think we need to get into that overlay. So I think that's the concern, that we would end up having to basically apply an overlay in order to put it to work. The last question that Mary asked before was around a capital grant, and when you think you're appropriate to recognise revenue under the capital grant scenario, which was, you know, when you're building the PP&E and over time as you build it, or over time as you're providing the goods and services. That's an interesting issue that's been under debate in a lot of different contexts, including in the public sector, where we've been looking at grants to build pieces of PP&E and then use it to provide over time. I think the IPCSB itself hasn't yet seen the outcome of that discussion. It's something that has been discussed in Australia, and in particular I've been thinking about, can we apply the IFRS 15 performance obligation thinking to a capital grant and see where we can take that. And I think the outcome has been that we can, with a bit of massaging, get to a point of potentially delaying revenue until you've built the asset on the grounds that the grant provider is basically wanting to provide a grant for you to build the piece of plant, as opposed to giving you cash and walking away. That in substance what they really want you to have is a constructed piece of plant. And so you can look at it that way, and therefore potentially defer revenue until you've built the plant. But going further than that becomes it is difficult to justify. I think you have to think about it in this environment, because all of the assets of that rate regulated activity, there's a requirement in your regulatory agreement to use them to provide services, whatever the good or services, to that customer base. So all of them have got that obligation coming with them. So if that's a performance obligation, then does that mean you have no assets because you're obliged to use them to provide these services? I'm not sure, you know, that's not where you're wanting to get to, obviously, but I think to take an argument and apply it in one context and then stop that polluting the rest of it where you're not wanting to apply that argument, I think that would be another challenge.
Okay, Patrick.
Just one quick remark on those two papers, and in particular the last one. Those two papers are fuel for thought, I think. I don't know if the IFRS 15 route is appropriate, because that's a bit too early. However, I'd like to point out that if you want to take into account the tripartite relationship, you have to jump one step, which is to say that because you operate in a monopolistic environment, then the customer has no choice if he wants energy or water or whatever. And therefore, by law, you have a regulator that is the spokesperson, the negotiating party, on behalf of the portfolio, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And it, at the end of the day, whether it will be the same client or another person but in the same monopolistic area, mm-hmm. is it that important? I don't know. So you have to jump conceptually from the idea of a one-to-one relationship, mm-hmm. to a more global relationship in the context of a monopoly. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying we should or we shouldn't, but I think that's what is, in my view, my takeaway from the discussion.
We have a very short lunch, so ask the two last speakers to be very short. Mary.
I was actually thinking of posing a question if anybody wanted to weigh in. It's really that last point that Patrick just raised, several others have touched on, is this model seems dependent in many places on identifying the customer base as the unit rather than individual customers.
Yes.
And Andreas has warned that it starts sounding a bit like open portfolios and dynamic risk, you know, the same issue. Mm-hmm. Do people have any reactions to whether this is fruitful or dangerous territory.
Well, let's not open a new round here.
Yeah.
Now.
But several people noted that and didn't observe whether they thought good or bad.
Okay, very quick question to Jingzhao. You suggest a very interesting issue, the current customers and future customers. It's the current customers can make some kind of claim to the government to refund something. I wonder what is the judicial decision on this issue legally? So you are saying existing customers, they are asking kind of a refund if they are overpaid, right? So what is the court decision on that issue? So they said it must be repaid to the current?
No, I don't say they must be repaid.
Uh-huh.
I say that the accounting should not change the reality, that the price is fair, even we think that it's overpaid, overpriced.
Okay.
Yeah, at that time, it's fair price, you know. We cannot change the reality.
Yeah.
Accountant cannot change the reality, you know.
The current generation, future generations, that is another typical issue in insurance contract, okay? So in the contract, our pool of the individual insurance contracts, however, some group of those large amount of contracts observing some losses, how about future generations getting some kind of maybe provide some subsidy to this contract? I'm saying there are different contracts in the world, just one individual contract basis. So I'm saying this sector, regulatory activities, and those contracts might be more related to, similarly, to insurance contracts. So that's why Andre is saying this is the customer base is different. Each other. So this might not be a tripartite transactions. So very complex transaction this is. So I'm saying we should expand our thought into more diverse contracts. So that's what I'm saying. Insurance is another good example.
Okay.
So Jane isn't here today, but she asked me to pass off a message that she will be back in December. And she's going to bring to you some of her ideas for the accounting model. So I'm quite pleased I won't be thinking about the customer base and the unit of account in a monopolistic market. I'll be leaving that one to Jane to consider.
Okay, thank you very much. We are now going to have lunch till 12:45.